Hey, South Bend City Church, Mariah here, the Director of Art and Worship. I am so thankful to be back with you all and so grateful that you chose to join us today. Whether you're local or long distance, we're thankful that you consider this to be your community. Before today's teaching, you'll actually hear Jason share our announcements and also share about the Post-Evangelical Collective, a gathering of kindred leaders and communities that we're a part of. In his introduction, he shared the manifesto from the Post-Evangelical Collective. On Sunday, we had a lot of people interested in revisiting the manifesto, so we included the text in the show notes below. All right, let's jump in with the rest of our community.
Good morning. Welcome to South Bend City Church. My name is Jason. We are honored that you are here. We've moved to this location not too long ago. I think this is our fifth Sunday here. And I know that with the move has brought sort of an extra amount of new faces, which we're really humbled by and grateful that if you are new that you tried to check this out. It does help that you can actually find us on Google Maps and not get led to a dead end when trying to find our location. That's a real upgrade for us, I know. We're glad that you're here, whether you've been here from the beginning or whether you're new. But if you are new, I'm aware that often as people try to get to know South Bend City Church, it can sort of like come with a question of like, what is this? It can be hard to categorize or maybe figure out where we're coming from or what we're doing, which is kind of intentional because some of the existing categories that are out there, we're not really sure they're great categories, which is why we're trying to create something a little bit different. But I had an experience this week that I wanted to report back to you on, both because SBCC was represented somewhere, whether you knew it or not, so you should know that. And also because what we were a part of this week is another sort of handle on who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. It's not the only handle, but it's one that might help. So let me back up a little bit. When South Bend City Church first got started in 2016 and 2017, I'll just speak for myself. I know I had the feeling that I would like to find like some kindred leaders and communities. I don't want to do this alone. I don't feel like what we're doing, like that we're the only ones doing it, but I also don't really know who else is doing it. And I was benefiting them from some mutual friends around the country who knew of other communities and other pastors who were doing something similar. And so they began to help us find each other and talk and connect. And as we found each other, we began to think we should find a way to actually get together for a minute and like compare notes and encourage each other. And so this is going back a few years now where with the help of a friend, we convened a gathering here in South Bend. And for lack of better language, we called it the Post-Evangelical Gathering. I'll say more about that in a minute too. We thought we'd have maybe a dozen leaders from around the country, and instead of 12, we had 120 show up, which suggested, oh, there's a lot of us out here who are trying to find each other and who agree in some sense that it's time for something a little bit different than the sort of predominant expressions of things that we see in church spaces. And so that thing that began a few years ago has kept going and it's taken on broader leadership. And this past week, the national gathering for that group happened down in Raleigh, North Carolina. Our friends at Church on Morgan hosted there. So I was there and others from our community were there. And so you were there whether you knew it or not in representation. But a really beautiful and powerful thing happened there as we learned from each other and took notes. This community of this growing collective of leaders, we have a bit of a manifesto which describes like, who we are and why we are finding each other. And I thought I would share this with you because it gives another handle on like where we're coming from and what we're up to. So maybe this helps. Now, before I read it to you, two disclaimers. One, there's a little bit of inside baseball in this document. And if some of the language you don't really identify with, that's totally cool. It's just like, it's inside language for church leadership. That's okay if you don't fully track. The other thing I'll tell you is this manifesto is a little bit spicy. And if it feels a little spicy, just hope you trust me when I say, while there might be some spice in the document, we're committed to holding these things with a lot of generosity and kindness. So that being said, let me share with you this manifesto. We are church leaders, artists, and other stakeholders who find ourselves estranged from the dominant expressions of American Christianity. We feel homeless in the larger church landscape because, while evangelicalism is the theological and cultural tradition that formed many of us, and while we're grateful for the gifts that we received from that lineage, we find its boundaries too narrow for our experience of God and its politics corrupted by an unchristlike vision. There's a little bit of spice, I know. We believe that every person is made in the image of Christ and have found that calling forth each person's inherent worth has led to our own loss of belonging. We seek a more just and inclusive expression of faith, but we reject the temptation to trade one exclusionary stance for another in the effort to address the need for justice and inclusion. We see the Spirit moving through new ideas and theological and liturgical visions, but we also embrace the depth and breadth of historical faith and worship. We believe that art and beauty are essential for vibrant spiritual community, but we have also seen how highly performative expressions of church can inadvertently diminish the space for authenticity, humanity, imperfection, and honesty, and distract from the attention we pay to the fruit of the Spirit growing in the lives of everyday people who follow Jesus together. We believe in the importance of deconstruction. It's a word that for some is really relevant right now. For others, you don't relate to that. But the idea of, you know, allowing some of your ideas to be torn down and rebuilt, right? But we also believe in rebuilding faith as followers of Jesus, and we're excited about inviting others into this way of life. We don't just want to take our cue from national church trends. I don't know if you know this, but sometimes pastors get together. And then, like, what happens in a normal Sunday at a normal church anywhere in the country is more influenced by that fancy pants gathering someplace else than what was happening in the community. So we say we don't just want to take our cue from national church trends. We take our cue from our local contexts. We believe our churches should look and sound and taste more like the neighborhoods they serve than the latest trends emerging from high-profile places. And then lastly, this. We believe a too rigid faith fails to acknowledge the mystery of God, but also believe mystery doesn't make God unknowable, but rather endlessly knowable. Yeah? So that's a little taste of some of the commitments that drew this gathering together in Raleigh. And it also gives a little bit of background on who Stop and City Church is. And since we were there this week, I wanted to share that with you. One other experience this week that moved me so much, I wanted to bring it home today. A number of people who showed up for this gathering in Raleigh this week, pastors, church staffers, artists, and others, a number of them have been, the technical word for it is they've been defrocked. Which, if you don't know what that means, it means that sometime earlier in their life, they were ordained by a denomination or a church where a community laid hands on them and affirmed their leadership in the church. And then later, those same people revoked that and basically said, we no longer affirm you and we're stripping you of your credentials as a member of the clergy. For some who've had that happen, it's because they themselves have come out as somebody who's L or G or B or T or Q. For others, it's that they've come out as an affirming ally or advocate for people who identify in that way. For others, it has to do with other doctrinal things, or perhaps no longer using the Bible to just endorse whatever American politics is doing, or maybe it has to do with believing that the Bible and modern science can be compatible when it comes to things like human origins and evolution. There's a lot of different reasons that these people have found themselves kicked out and stripped of their credentials. But in this gathering, we did a refrocking. I know this all sounds maybe very inside, but this post-evangelical collective, we don't claim like an ordaining power, like a denomination or anything like that, but there's this really simple moment in the Gospels where a man named Peter, who had been following Jesus as a disciple, then sort of is on the run after Jesus is crucified and resurrected, and Jesus comes to him and he finds him and he basically calls him back to the work with a simple question, which is like, do you love me? Well, then go and feed my sheep. It's that simple. And so a number of these people who've been defrocked gathered in the center of the room. Kevin, who was leading this moment, it was so simple and beautiful. He looked each one in the eye and just said, do you love Jesus? And many of them with the kind of fervor and emotion that reminds me of how absurd it is that they were kicked out, said yes. And then the commission was really simple, feed his sheep. And then a number of us had the privilege of laying our own hands on them and affirming them again. And I know most of you here in this room have neither been frocked nor defrocked. That's not your story. But there are resonances with many of you that for one reason or another, you've found yourself a little bit homeless. Maybe from a different world than the one that I just described, but you found yourself a little bit homeless. And I think a lot of us are finding a home together again with God and with one another. And I was down there this week, so grateful to bring you with me in my heart. And now I'm here right now, really grateful to bring all that back here and to let you know that we're not alone. And there's just some really beautiful stuff happening, and it may not get all the headlines, But there are brave, creative, and faithful expressions of church bubbling up all over right now. And it's a really powerful antidote to the cynicism that I sometimes feel about what's happening in the world at this moment. So I wanted to like impart that back to you in case it encourages you today. If you are trying to figure out Southland City Church, maybe you've been here for only a little while, or maybe you've been here for quite a while, but you still haven't had a chance to take a step into community with us or into getting to know us. We've got a great opportunity for you coming up in a couple of weeks. It's our new to Southland City Church table. It's happening again on Sunday, May 5th, right after the 11 a.m. gathering here at the Tribune. This is a chance for us to share a meal together. I'll be there, other members of our staff will be there. We'll kind of tell our story a bit, both as a church, and then our individual stories as members of the team, where we're coming from, what we do here at the church. But then we'll turn it over to you, and we'd love to hear from you. Like, who are you, and like, why'd you come? Like, what brought you here, and perhaps why'd you stay, if so far you've stayed? And it's a chance to get to know your own story. You'll also have a chance to ask any question you have. We're really committed to being an open book around here. Sometimes you come to a new church, and you're kind of like, yeah, but what's really behind the curtain? That's a fair question, and we want you to have a chance to inquire about all that, so you can bring your questions as well. We'd love to have you. Just make sure you sign up. There are limited seats available because we're committed to having one shared table and one big meal. So go to southlandcitychurch.com and look for the What's Happening tab on the website. You can sign up there. That'll make sure that we have food for you as well. And then kids are very welcome to be a part of this. However, we don't have separate childcare, but we'd love to have the kids at the table with us for the meal. Coming up on May 5th, sign up online. Lastly, if you'd like to support all this financially, it makes a world of difference. Just go to southlandcitychurch.com/give. And with that, I will conclude the world's longest announcements in the history of Southland City Church and ask Mariah to lead us further.
All right. So once again, if you want to revisit that manifesto, it's available in the show notes below, as well as sign-ups for the new to Southland City Church table in May, and a link to give if that's something you want to do. All right. So we're still in Romans, specifically chapters 9 through 11, where Paul wrestles with questions about his own Jewish people's place and the ongoing story of God's faithfulness. Thanks again for joining us. Let's jump in with the rest of our community now.
A few years ago, a novel came out called A Little Life. Has anybody read this? Well, I highly recommend it, but also there's some spoilers about to happen, so it's too late. It's been out since like 2015. That's like fair margin, right? Statute of limitations, I can tell you what happens. It's a renowned book, critically acclaimed, and it's profound and kind of heartbreaking. There's a main character in it named Jude, and you learn early on in the book that Jude, early in his life, suffered staggering degrees of abandonment and abuse, just the worst kinds of things. And one of the ways that that early wounding shows up regularly in his life is through a pattern of self-harm that's really tragic. Jude also, though, finds a sense of family in his adult life when, in particular, a professor of his, a professor and mentor, that man and his wife, approach Jude at the age of 30 and say, "We want to adopt you. We want to like fully claim you. We choose you, we love you, and you are a part of this family." And you watch with Jude as he struggles. On the one hand, it's like everything he's ever wanted. And on the other hand, he's absolutely terrified that it's not true, you know, that they've made a mistake, that they're deceived, that once they get to know who he really is, which if you read the novel, the irony and the tragedy is they clearly know him through and through. They know this guy. They love this guy. But he has such a hard time believing it. And you see all those sort of early stories that he was told, the ones that he carries in his body. These stories of abandonment and abuse, they actually sort of rage within him as he like can't compute the simple fact of his belovedness and belonging with this family and the fact that in their love they've chosen him, period, full stop. And they want to like go on the record and go to the courts and say, we choose Jude, he's one of ours, and we love him and he belongs. And I'm reading the novel and really torn up about it, because on the one hand, I can identify with Jude in some ways, not to the severity of his experience, but to the underlying theme, that there's so many things that get stacked up in our lives that convince us that we're unworthy, that surely we don't belong, that we wouldn't be chosen, right? And on the other hand, I'm like on the outside of his life. I'm like, oh, dude, like I'm rooting for him. I'm cheering for him. I'm like, dude, don't you see? Like this family has every reason to love you. They've chosen you. You should trust this, right? And in those two experiences, the one where I can kind of identify with him and the other one where I'm on the outside thinking, oh, dude, like love doesn't calculate. I get it. That's the problem. Love doesn't compute. And there's so much within us that wants it to make sense. And love actually doesn't make sense. It doesn't sort of arrive after a calculus, right? It doesn't create a chart of strengths and weaknesses in you and then choose to love. Like, that's not what real love is. Real love doesn't compute and doesn't rise and fall on worthiness. That's not what real love is, right? In Jude's case, you see the way that this sort of human pathology that we all carry, where we want love to compute, like, here's why I'm worthy of it, here's why I'm worthy to belong. Like, we see how that can turn against ourselves. And in his case, it's warring against himself, and it wounds himself, right? There's also the ways that we turn that outward, and we put it on everybody else. We try to sort of sift and sort the world and decide who's in and who's out and who belongs and who's worthy, rather than allow our brains to get rewired around the strange mystery of love that doesn't have any regard for those calculations, but simply chooses you and wants you to belong. And I tell you all that because we're deep in the weeds in the letter called Romans. And I think that lays an important sort of backdrop for where we're going today. So if you've been around for the last, 37 months, you know that we're doing a letter called Romans. We've been in it for a while, off and on. But if not, let me sort of brief you on what this letter is and why we're doing it. So Romans is in the New Testament. It's one of the big important texts in the New Testament. It's been really influential for the last 2,000 years. A lot of theology, a lot of energy has been drawn from it and given to it. A guy named Paul writes this letter a few decades after the life of Jesus to the Christians who are in Rome, and Paul's not been there yet. So he sends this ahead of himself, although he hopes to visit them later. And it seems that maybe one of the reasons that Paul is writing this letter is to preserve the miraculous thing that's happening in the church, which is that Jewish believers and Gentile believers are all belonging to one another, in spite of the fact that they have every reason not to belong to each other. And forget about Jews and Gentiles for a moment. Just think about human beings in groups, right? If you sort of set out assuming that there's only so much love and only so much belonging to be had in the world, if you assume a kind of scarcity of all of those resources of love and belonging, right? Well, then you're gonna sift and sort the world, and you're gonna hope that you're in the group that gets those things, and you're gonna be quick to find out who the groups are that you don't think are worthy of those things, and that's a way of making sense of all this stuff. But what if it doesn't make sense? That's part of the problem, right? So Paul writes a letter, and he's trying to protect this, and there's probably a historical circumstance that is driving some of these tensions there. Again, I know this is review for those of you who've been following along. What we know is that earlier than the letter was written, there was a period of time where a Roman emperor had evicted all of the Jews from Rome, and then the emperor had died, and with him, his edict died. And so in the church, what you've got is a movement that begins as a Jewish movement. So it's kind of like the Jewish believer's house, right? Because Jesus is Jewish, and the movement starts as a Jewish movement, and then the Gentiles are included, but they're sort of second to arrive at the house, right? But in Rome, imagine what was first a Jewish house that began to welcome Gentile believers. Then when the Jewish believers are exiled, becomes a Gentile house. And now that the exile is over, the Jewish believers are coming back to a house that used to be theirs, right? But now the Gentiles are running the place. So you can imagine all the group dynamics, all the tensions that bubble up when human beings are navigating these kind of lines of difference, right? And in Paul's letter, you can see all these ways that he's pushing and pulling and trying to bring these people back together. And we've mapped some of the arguments, but we're in a really kind of tricky part of the letter in chapters 9 through 11, where Paul's working on a particular problem. So the problem, and again, I know this is review if you were here the last couple of weeks, the problem that he's working out on the page is himself as a Jewish follower of Jesus, he looks at his own Jewish people. And whereas when he looks at Jesus, he sees the fulfillment that all the promises that God gave his own Jewish people, he sees all of that fulfillment located in Jesus. But he looks at a bunch of his Jewish brothers and sisters, and a lot of them are not coming along for the ride. And so he's got to figure out what to do with that, because his whole life, he's believed that God's going to be faithful to his people, the Jewish people, and bring them along in the story that he had promised them. And now he looks, and a lot of them aren't coming along in what he believes is the fulfillment of that story. But all these outsiders are in on the story, right? So he's got to work that out in Romans 9 through 11. We've already been in the text, but I'm going to carry a little bit further here. What's interesting is if you look at the last part of this movement, chapter 11, whereas chapters 9 and 10, it gets like really fuzzy what he actually is saying about his Jewish kindred people and where they fit into the story. But then we get to Romans 11 and he takes a turn. So with all that backdrop, you guys feel like we're good? We ready to jump in? Same page? Ish. Cool. Romans 11, 1. He says this, I ask then, did God reject his people? And here he's talking about the Jews, the Israelites, right? And he says, by no means. A little bit further in the letter, he says, again, I ask, did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. That's an interesting play. But if their transgression means riches for the world and their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater riches will their full inclusion bring? A little further, skipping ahead in the letter, he says this. It's if some of the branches have been broken off and you, though a wild olive shoot, have been grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing sap from the olive root, do not consider yourself to be superior to those other branches. Let's pause there for a sec. Who's he talking to at this point? When he says, you who are the wild branches, what's interesting is at this point in the argument, he's talking to the Gentile believers. That's how you know it here, because when he says, you are a wild shoot, that's not language for the Jewish believers. They're part of the original tree in his thinking, right? So now he's moving his argument. Pay attention to what he's doing here, not just what he's saying here, right? He's speaking to the Gentile part of the church, and he's got this whole point about, like, let me remind you, you were grafted into this thing, so don't you get all uppity about those other people, right? Next slide. If you do, consider this. You do not support the root, but the root supports you. You will say then, branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. Granted, but they were broken off because of unbelief, and you stand by faith. Don't be arrogant, but tremble. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he will not spare you either. Consider therefore the kindness and sternness of God. Sternness to those who fell, but kindness to you, provided that you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. And if they do not persist in unbelief, they will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. Good, let's go a little bit further. One last passage here. I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of the Gentiles has come in, and in this way, all Israel will be saved. So however you make sense of the text that we were in the last couple of weeks where Paul's working out the promises to the Jewish people and why some of them have responded and some of them haven't, note what Paul does here at the end of this stretch through chapters 9 and 11. He basically calls out the Gentile half of the church and says, whatever you think about the Jewish people and how they fit into all of this, don't you get uppity, right? It's interesting. In the first few chapters of Romans, we looked at this, you know, several years ago. Thank you. We looked at this a while ago. In the first few chapters of Romans that we studied in the fall, or Lent, it was during Lent. It was during Lent that we looked at those chapters. Paul talks about the wrath of God being directed against people whose behaviors sound like Gentile behaviors, right? So he's talking about all God's wrath against these really like bad, idolatrous behaviors of people. And you can tell if you read closely that by doing that and casting this kind of negative language against Gentile behaviors, you can imagine the Jewish believers are getting a little uppity, right? And then he takes that early in the letter and he turns it against the Jewish believers and says, you're no different. So early, one of his movements is he sort of casts aspersions against the Gentiles just to draw out Jewish self-righteousness, so he can turn it against the Jews. Later in the letter, in chapters 9 through 11, he does the exact same thing in reverse. You catch this? He's speaking in a way that you can imagine the Gentile believers being like, yeah, we're the ones who are really the center of the plot line now, right? And then you get to chapter 11, and he says, not so fast. Now, throughout the letter, it's like over and over again, you can feel Paul doing something. Again, like, if you stay at the level of what he said, and then you try to like build and stack up these eternal systematic doctrines of theology, I think it's really easy to go wrong. But if you pay attention to what he's doing, like what are these ideas doing in the community? What effect would they have on these people? You're going to end up with a different read on the whole thing. And it seems, again, that Paul's trying to like remind this community, like, hey, anywhere there's a superiority where you feel like you belong more because of who you are or what you've done, and the way that you feel cozy is you look at somebody else and you call them an outsider. That's how you make yourself feel secure as an insider. It's like anywhere he sees that happening, he leverages complex arguments and theologies just to push back against all of that. I think that's what Paul's actually doing here. It's like this. It's like Paul knows that we so badly want to make sense of who's in and who's out. And we want to calculate all of that based on our virtue. And the strange, subversive, dismantling power of Paul's gospel is that it just doesn't work that way. And that you're here because love wanted you here, and they're here because love wanted them here, and all of us find ourselves in the center of the story with God, not because we built ourselves up to earn it, but simply because love called you here, wanted you here, chose you to be here right now. We made it this far in Romans, and I've failed you on one major front, which is I've not shown you the text within Romans that many scholars believe is the thesis statement of the whole letter. Now, remember like in high school, you're learning how to write papers in English class, right? And you have to have your thesis statement, right? Like early in the first paragraph, you're supposed to have your thesis statement where you clarify the point that you're making, and then the rest of the paper is where you argue for it and you explain it, right? Right? Well, a lot of scholars think that Paul has a thesis statement in early Romans, and then the next 16 chapters, they argue, are Paul basically proving in a number of different movements this thesis statement, or like fleshing out what it means. And they say that Romans 9 through 11 is one of those proofs, one of those argument stretches that explains and proves the earlier thesis. So let me show you what they say the thesis statement is. This is from chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. And many say that those two lines are the thesis statement of this whole letter. I've got a gospel, I'm not ashamed of it, and it's for Jew and Gentile belonging together, not through virtue, but by the righteousness of God, by the character of God, the nature of God to draw you in and invite you by faith and trust to be a part of this thing, right? Now, I don't know if you have, did any of you grow up around language of like not being ashamed of the gospel? Yeah, you've been around that stuff? I know I do. There's a lot of like, don't be ashamed of the gospel. Don't be ashamed of the gospel. And growing up, like middle school Jay, high school Jay, I had a lot of thoughts about what that seemed to mean. And some of that was based on how I heard the adults talk about it. And some of that was just my own interpretation stuff, right? But like, don't be ashamed of the gospel. And I had this feeling that, like, for example, that meant that, like, my family experience, if I'm being honest, is like, on Sunday, you know, we'd hang out with the Christians. And to be honest, they're a little weird. And then I go to school and there's the cool kids. And the cool kids talk and behave differently than the people I hang out with on Sunday. And what I kind of felt was like, my job is to be really proud of this thing over here, and we're kind of weird, and then to not want to go along with the cool kids over here. And what sucked about that was the cool kids got to do a lot of fun things. Like mostly revolving around like sex and cursing, right? But like, it was like they have that whole thing and they feel very free and clear, and I'm not a part of that because I'm a part of this, and my job is not to be ashamed of this, even though that seems really cool, right? Anybody else? Yeah, okay. Or to not be ashamed of this gospel meant that I was supposed to have really awkward conversations with my friends in the hallway about whether they knew they were going to heaven or hell when they died, right? You know, like, do you know the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ? And like, by the way, here's lunch and let's go to class, right? Like, that's what this actually felt like to me. And I'm not saying that's entirely wrong, actually. There's probably some truth in all of that. But a lot of that misses the context for Paul to talk about not being ashamed of the gospel. So let me see if I can put all this together for you. Hang with me through a couple of things, okay? Paul is living and writing at a time where honor and shame are primary categories that structure their social world. Let me say that again. Paul's living at a time where honor and shame are primary categories that structure their social world. So the more honor you have, the higher up the chain you are, and the more you belong in the center of things. And the more shame you have, as other people judge it, the less you belong in the center and the less power you're going to have. And the way that you say gain honor or gain shame has as much to do with how you're born or what has happened to you as it does with how you behave. So people are born into different class structures at that time, and wherever you're born into in that class structure affects your status with honor and shame. but also other things that happen to you can affect your status along the spectrum of honor and shame in that culture. And if you were to imagine what could happen to a person, what could we see publicly happen to you that would help us locate you at the extreme shame end of the spectrum, which puts you all the way on the outside or all the way at the bottom. If we imagine, like, what could happen to you? What could we see about you? What could we learn about you that would put you all the way at the shame end of the spectrum on the line between honor and shame? There's one thing in particular that might be as intense as you can get on the shame end of the spectrum, and it's this: to have your body hung on a cross. I mean, crucifixion is engineered not just to create suffering for the individual, but to shame that person. So their naked body hangs on that wood in a very public place, that body having been brutalized, to shame that person in front of everyone. And in a society where everything works on the basis of honor and shame, where that's the spectrum that creates social categories, that's a really powerful way to tell other people, if you don't want to end up shamed like this person, get in line, right? So you take all that as background, and then you hear Paul writing about, I'm not ashamed of this gospel of Jesus Christ. He is playing with fire. He's allowing these categories of human structure that help us decide who's in and who's out and who belongs where in the hierarchy, all that's getting blown up because he worships the man whose body hung on a cross. He gives all of this honor to Jesus, who experienced the worst kind of shame, which blows up all these categories, disrupts everything. Now, we may not work with honor and shame explicitly as the way that we order our world, but we still do all of this. We still, like, our brain wants it to make sense. We want to order the world around us in a way that makes sense. We want to order Christian communities in ways that make sense. We want neat and tidy lists and categories of who's in and who's out and why they're in and why they're out. We do this to ourselves and we do it to each other. When we do it to ourselves, we end up not unlike that character Jude, who tragically in this novel just can't bring himself to accept the simple truth of his beloved belonging in that family that wants to adopt him. And he inflicts like really problematic, like really tragic harm against himself, because at least that makes sense to him. Because how else would he make sense of all that has happened to him in his life? And so sometimes we direct it against ourselves, and sometimes we direct it against others, and we want to order our world and order our communities on who's most deserving of belonging at the center of things. And I think the gospel that Paul is preaching is meant to dismantle all of that, just to break it down. It is so much safer and easier to think that we are in or out on the basis of our performance, and that you are in or out on the basis of your performance, than to embrace this gospel, beautiful, big idea, which is maybe it is entirely a matter of God's character. But that's really scary because we're not in charge of God's character, right? Which brings us to the language of faith or trust, which is at the center of response to this gospel, which is to allow your heart to be rewired away from the logic and the tallies and the scorekeeping that helps us decide who's in or out, and instead simply says, at the center of reality is an unfailing love. That even though I've never seen a perfect example of, there's an unfailing love at the center of reality that chooses us and calls us to belonging. And the unfailing nature of that, which is a little bit of what Paul means by the righteousness of God. God's willingness and ability to live up to God's own love. And to choose you and to call you and to keep telling you that you belong, no matter who you are or what you've done. This seems to be at the heartbeat of this gospel. And so Paul has to deal with this thing about the Jewish believers and the Gentile believers, because he knows that in that community, it's one of the clear dividing lines where one group is thinking better of itself at the expense of the other group, and that seems to go in both directions. And he says, don't you know that has nothing to do with the operating system that God has installed here with the gospel? That these hierarchies like make no sense when it's all love, it's all divine choosing, it's all divine calling, it's all God simply saying, you are here because love wants you here and has chosen you. Now, I've been wondering to myself, where have I seen the power of what happens when people embrace this, where they really believe it? where the unfailing character and love of God is something like held tightly to. And in spite of like what has happened to you or what you've done, or like no matter whether the shaming has been put on you or whether you've put it on yourself, like where have I seen the power of somebody who holds on to all this? And I gotta be honest with you, the person who came to mind for me, the example that stood out to me, is our dear friend Zach Gillis, who leads worship up here sometimes. Y'all know Zach. Zach leads worship for us, and Zach also is the director for care for our community. And so if you find yourself in need of some pastoral care, Zach's kind of our frontline leader for all of that. And I've heard Zach say this phrase over and over again over the years as we share our lives and I learn his story. I'll tell you the phrase in a moment. But the phrase stands out to me as an example of somebody who's holding on to what I'm talking about, meaning no matter what's happened to you, no matter how we want to divide the world between who's in or who is out, that you can simply hold on to like God's unfailing love toward you and also God's unfailing love toward everybody else, right? But in this case, God's unfailing love toward you. I'll never know firsthand what it's like to be a gay black man growing up in America, in religious spaces, the way that Zach has. But I learn more and more the more I sit with Zach and listen to him and hear his story. And over again, Zach will tell some part of his story, but then here's this phrase, God isn't gonna play me. It's his way of naming the faithfulness of God. God isn't gonna play me. And I think about all the reasons that Zach, for example, would have to associate the shame that people have put on him. Whether it's the sometimes subtle and sometimes loud ways that white supremacy shows up, or whether it's the exclusion of gay people like Zach in Christian spaces. I think about all the ways that shame has been put on Zach and how I can imagine it would be so tempting to think that that's telling him the truth about God and about whether he's in or whether he's out. But somehow, and I love and admire this about my friend, and I want to learn more about it from him. By the way, you should know that I asked Zach if I could say all this. That's important. Because it's his story, but he gave me a green light to do this today. But every time I hear that guy say, God isn't going to play me, I think that's actually what Paul's working out in this letter. The righteousness of God, which is not like some purity code God. It's God's willingness and ability to live up to God's own promise to God's people. That's the righteousness of God in Paul's categories. That God loves the way that God said God was going to love. And that when God chose you, God never gave up on choosing you. That's what's meant by the righteousness of God in these stories here. And so that explains why Paul's got to like grip these people and say, stop dividing the world between those who are in and those who are out on the basis of some structure that you have built. And instead just like surrender, throw up your hands, like give over yourself to the idea that it's simply love that wants you here and it doesn't make sense. And when I see Zach standing confidently in that goodness and kindness and that choosing of God, in that love, I'm reminded I have more to learn about this. But that's actually the current flowing through the gospel, and that's what will draw together a church under this gospel. And to not be ashamed of this gospel is to not be ashamed to shout and say that it doesn't work the way we think it works. And that all of our attempts to adjudicate who's in and who's out, they will never not break the world. You know that? But if we can lay hold of God who is righteous, which is to say God lives up to God's promise to love, if we can hold that in front of ourselves and we can direct it toward ourselves and direct it toward others, then that's like a gospel that actually changes the world in real and practical ways. And so Romans 9 through 11, they're kind of gnarly, I'll be honest. I still have a lot of questions about what Paul's doing, but a few things are emerging for me that are clear, and I think Paul really believes that you've got to relocate all the action, not in your performance or their performance, but in the unfailing character of God, who will never fail to love and to choose and to call you and me and our enemies into the center of belonging. And so I feel a little bit like I'm rooting for all of you the way I'm rooting for Jude in this novel right now. I'm rooting for us. I know it doesn't make sense. And I know we have all these reasons to exclude others and to exclude ourselves. But over and against all of that, the love of God says it just doesn't work that way. Mariah led us in a song earlier in the gathering, and we're going to come back to it to try to just like hold this a little deeper for a moment before we go. And so if you're able, will you stand to your feet and we'll sing. So may we not be ashamed of the gospel, of the radical revelation that God's not in the business of tallying honor and shame to decide who belongs. May we not be ashamed of a gospel predicated on the unending love of God. May we not be ashamed of a gospel that trusts that God lives up to God's own promise to love and to love and to love. And may we extend that belonging not only to ourselves, to welcome every part of ourselves in this family, but to our neighbors and even to our enemies. And may grace and peace be with you. Amen. Love you all. See you soon.